There can be a lot of emphasis put on selflessness as the key to happiness, or the approach that we must take to be an effective ally or activist. The idea is we should put others first, always. This attitude is part of what leads to the need for conversations about self-care, and it can limit altruism to only counting if we don't feel good about it. But when we are engaged in any work that aims to alleviate suffering, we must remember to include ourselves in the equation and learn to see how effective, lasting change starts when we do our own work. In this episode, I collaborate with Tada Hozumi to examine how we can be wisely selfish by learning how to be in our bodies. They invite us to rethink our whole approach to social action by questioning the effectiveness of things like call-out culture and privilege shaming. By not thinking transactionally, Tada says we can't help but take a different approach, one based on emotional self-responsibility. This approach, they say, is one of social restoration, which is collaborative, compassionate, and grounded in somatic awareness. Hi, Tada. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Hello.
So to start off, I ask my guests to share a bit about growing up and at what point it was that you started to see yourself as either a social activist, agent for change, whatever it is. At what point you moved from I am suffering to there is suffering?
That's a really interesting question. You know, I'm Japanese, so there's like a mix of different spiritual traditions in the family at any given time, right? And, you know, Buddhism is one of those influences. So I had a very early sense of this whole idea of life is suffering. There's this comic book series called Buddha, if you've ever read it.
I've heard of it, and I see it around, and I always want to read it.
Yeah, it's an incredible, like, kind of slightly fictional, well, very fictional story of Siddhartha. And that had a huge impact on me. So the life is suffering part, like the there is suffering part, is always part of my mind. But the other side is that I felt really challenged by the idea that we're supposed to be nice to other people, because the only experience that we can have is of our own. So what, like, and it was more of like a kind of very stubborn part of me ever since I was young. It's like, if you can't say that being nice to other people, quote unquote, right, is to the benefit of self, there's no power in that. There's no power in that conversation. There's no art. There's nothing to for that being nice to be on, to stand on, to be founded on. And so that's been like kind of like, so that was really young, early thought. And, you know, you see this now that we're selfish activists really points to that kind of original sentiment of how I felt a lot of just cognitive dissonance with the idea of being loving and being a certain kind of way, and it didn't register. Yeah. And I think it's interesting. I think there's a lot of reasons why that is, and some of it's ancestral, and you know, as I learn more. But I came to there, I mean, more like, I guess, activist-y position. I don't love that word for many reasons, but when I started dancing, so I was a club kid, but then in my 30s, I started taking up dancing as like a more serious hobby. And then the dance I do is called popping. So it's a mechanical robotic dance from the west coast of Turtle Island down south. And the artistic research I was doing around that time was about the polar opposite ideas of embodiment in Turtle Island is like, you know, white people can't dance, and then, like, black people can dance. And I'm kind of in the middle, like, navigating, trying to understand how those things mean. So that's kind of been, like, was my artistic research at the time. And so, that, you know, that's why I started, that's part of why I was dancing, to be that self-anthropological research. And then there was this moment, I was, like, practicing, I was getting divorced at the time, actually, and so all I could do was just train. Like I said, popping is a mechanical dance. So the foundation is a robot. And it was really interesting. There was just a moment in my body I understood that, and this is, it brings up emotion right away, that this dance is about like black bodies being mechanized, being used in a capitalist system And because the west coast of the states had all these car factories and a new middle class working class that were mostly black and brown. And so in these, they go to these factories and work and also sent to war, right? And so their bodies are being used in a way that's mechanized. And the dance speaks to like how that culture of monotony and precision combine with African feeling and becomes funk music. And so the dance itself describes that place of resilience of black and brown people. It embodies it and brings emotions up because I realized in that moment that there's this gift coming from the soma, the body of a community of people that had to survive. And I'm accessing it for my own kind of healing journey from a divorce. And these things are actually interconnected. And like, what a gift. But also in that moment, somatically, there's this very strong, oh, this is how a little bit touching in on how black people feel in their body. It's not a like cognitive kind of going like, I understand what these experiences, these are the experiences. It's more of like, oh, this is the soul somatic language of the culture. And I think that was when something really shifted in that understanding. So that's kind of when that connected the place of me, like wanting to heal myself through this divorce, right? And I'm not really a politically oriented person at that time. I really didn't give a shit, actually, because I said I was a selfish person in the world, and I stayed there because I felt it was my place of integrity, right? In a strange way. But then in that somatic connection to culture and then black activism, like something, I don't like the word woke. I think it trivializes something, but something awakened in a very like meditative sense. So this is the kind of thing I've been looking for, is like how do we found the idea of, I call it social restoration, not social change anymore, but how do we find the idea of social re how do we found this idea of social restoration on top of the body? Because that is where the self and other collapse, the subject and collapse and experience of the body. So that was the moment. And you know what? It's not that long ago. It's only like, say, like 7 years. It's pretty short. I mean, very different from a lot of, I think, activists, because I feel like a lot of people are born activists as like 14 or something. And I was like, I was gambling for a living for like 7 to 8 years before that. Like, I'm in the, if you want to talk about it, like just diehard doggy dog emblem of kind of like a capitalist fantasy, I was doing it. And so I just come from actually like a very different place in that sense.
Talking about activism, or what was it that you said, social
Social restoration.
restoration, social
Yeah.
restoration.
Yeah. The reason why I don't like activism is because it places, so I'm really, really interested in de-Westernizing, decolonizing our I'll say it once, social justice language, and look at the biases inside of it. Like activism creates a bias towards acting, which is an incredibly Western concept of being in the world. It's very Yang, right? First of all, when you actually look at
It's
it,
like a very doing energy.
yeah, things have to be done, direct action, da da da. And it's like, well, actually, there's so much more happening than acting. There's a lot of being that has to be planned for. And so, like in my practice, on a heated day, you would catch me saying tearing down the entire system of how we approach things, like rebuild it. And actually, that is what I'm doing, is rebuilding the practice of what we call activism on top of East Asian spiritual philosophy. So it's from the ground up. Like, I don't feel connected to what people normally call social justice, because actually that's not what I do. I speak the language sometimes, but that's not a perception of what I do actually.
So it's less of a tearing down, and it's more of a building something new.
Well, I already tore down for myself. I
For
already like,
yourself.
I burnt out. There's a lot of reactivity in social justice community, right? And I just had to take time away. And you know, it's really easy for me because I'm really selfish. So I was like, I hate this. I'm done. Like, it was very quick. It wasn't that hard for me to step away in some sense, but there's definitely a lot of relationships that went south. And inside of that, I was like, what is wrong? And I was like, well, I feel like maybe we're going on a tangent, but maybe you're interested.
No, I this was something that I was prepared to touch on with you, actually, because my experience of activism, like I was an activist when I was 14. I very much identified as an activist, and I totally burnt out. And that was because my view of it was, if I fix everything around me, then I'll be okay. Mm. And then it took a lot of therapy and establishing a very strong Buddhist practice for me to take a completely different approach, which is like what you take, which is, you know, start with yourself in order to be of benefit to others. And I agree, like, for me, I feel really uncomfortable with the word activist purely because of the connotations that go with it, with the way that I see a lot of activist communities expressing a lot of anger ineffectively. I think there are effective ways to express anger. I think shouting at people, name calling, telling people they're bad or wrong.
Yeah.
I have yet to see that actually work.
I could tell you a lot about that. There's so much, right? You just opened up a can of worms.
Well, I guess what I would love for you to talk about is your own journey on the path of realizing the seeming paradox, because I don't think it is actually a paradox, but the seeming paradox that you help others by helping yourself.
Yeah, and I think the neuroscience of that is only being understood now. But as you know, I facilitate a group called the Authentic Allyship Coaching Group. It's kind of almost like a funny name also in and of itself, because I have a little bit of humor in me that's a little bit snappy. But the concept of allyship that I base on comes through. So there's Hakomi. Do you know Hakomi? Hakomi is kind of like mindfulness-based somatic therapy.
Okay, I've heard of it.
Mr. Ron Kurtz, and then one of his students and legacy holders at Hakomi is Donna Martin. And one of my loves in my life was a Hakomi student, and I also saw a Hakomi therapist for a while. So this current practice is very influenced by that. But one thing that Hakomi has, and I'm going to also put in an acknowledgement about indigenous influence around this, but like what I learned through interacting with Hakomi is the idea that Donna calls it simply being. And it just brings so much just to say that. It's like, is the idea that simply being yourself, so attuned to your senses and present, is the most nourishing and healing state you can be for somebody else. And the therapeutic relationship is founded on simply being. And so, to me, allyship begins and ends with simply being yourself. And that means just present and fully attuned in the senses and the people that you are with. And, of course, that's a nourishing state for self to be in. That resonance is everything. You know, all the rest of the stuff that we talk about doesn't mean a thing until there's simply being underneath everything. So, you know, I've been getting called out like a lot on the internet right now. And this, so it's very interesting, the subject, but we can talk about that later. But I was pretty exhausted because there's a lot of stuff was going around recently. And I was at the sauna, and then there was this indigenous elder person who is holding space in the sauna, which he called White Man's Sweat Lodge. I was like, oh my gosh. He was talking to a white man about a sense of belonging and initiation of men and ritual and stuff like that. So I just kind of got into conversation with him. And one thing he said was like, in a sense, we do the same work. Because he's in the sauna, white man's sauna, talking to white men about ritual and belonging and mentoring them. And I do this work group online. So we're actually kind of like colleagues. He's actually kind of my mentor. Like, he just kind of became a mentor in the moment. And, you know, he's like, what do? You just hold space for play, space, and time. There's that piece of simply being right there, right? And so that to me is everything. And I think when we talk about how we relate in social justice culture doesn't support that, and the dominant understanding of how to relate does not support that. And so that is something that I'm a, I don't know, advocate for, or I feel like that's too weak of a word, but I'm also hesitant to give this really strong word. But I also think there's a paradigm shift coming in social justice culture, or social, like, it's going to switch over to social restoration. Somatic practice is going to become the foundation for that. And, you know, call out culture is going to get indicted.
Well, I mean, it's happening, right? Like, you see it. I was in a Radical Dharma webinar that I attended, yeah. And I jokingly made a comment about being woke, and I'm starting to hear that where people are making these jokes about being woke, not woke. And Lama Rod Owens then took that up and was like, yeah, you know, the problem with that is there's this very black and white, like, are you good or are you bad? Are you on side or are you not? Have you woken up? Have you not woken up? And then one of the people who was also in attendance, who was in the chat, said, what about waking? And I was like, yeah, exactly. Like, you create some movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about you are or you aren't. It's about, are you in process? And we're always in process. And where we are in that process is different. And, like, meeting people at that. I think, like, what you're saying about when you can meet yourself where you're at, then you can meet other people where they're at.
Yeah. Like, we can be okay in every moment that we exist, even though we're unwell in some sense. We're always unwell, but we can always be well in every single moment we choose to be and still become more well. It's a mystery, right? And, you know, I hear you so much, and I'm so glad to talk to you about this, because I think it's a really polarizing thing. And in social justice community, I think we don't, it's coming out, and I'm really writing about it and talking about it. And it's, I think it's rubbing people in a place of discomfort, is that it's built on top of ableism. In the sense that there's absolute disrespect for the nervous system. And so when people call things like white fragility, male fragility, and pejoratively call a culture in and of itself with no accountability or upper bound for the person calling out, which is actually re-traumatizing the person calling out, actually, because, you know, their nervous system is going on overdrive and putting themselves in a conflict situation that is likely re-traumatizing, because catharsis in an unfriendly situation re-traumatizing the nervous system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the person on the other side is also traumatized by it, but not allowing language for it. You know, the idea of even calling whiteness a mental illness, I hate the word mental illness, quote unquote, but as far as the kind of pockets that we understand, you know, containers that we understand the world in, whiteness is a mental illness. Or I call it, you know, like my coaching group calls it somatic unwellness, because we don't like the term mental illness, but that's a good language. We're developing new language actually in the group itself.
Yeah. Right? Unwellness, I like that, and woundedness. Like, you know, it's a wound. It's something that can heal.
Yeah.
And that needs to heal.
Resiliency, maybe. You know, who knows? Mm-hmm. But it's just, there's so little regard for the nervous system, and that is indefensible to me. And you know, I just go no. Like, I keep looking at it and going, no, like, no. And I think it's really scary, because a lot of the violence and lateral violence that gets hurled around is justified by not looking at that piece and not, you know, not taking it to heart, because the human body can't tell the difference between a call out and a bear attacking you. Cannot.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The nervous system is what it is. It operates unconsciously, you know, the autonomic nervous system. So saying somebody like, you need to listen to me because X is not going to work. It's just not a possibility. It's like, it's almost like we need to grieve the reality of that, come into something new.
Yeah.
And it does take a bit of grief. It needs, you know, you have to let go of the idea that you cannot fight this thing. Mm. It will not get you anywhere.
Yeah. I'd love to talk to you a bit then about emotional labor, because like no one gets out of emotional labor, but there's an imbalance generally that's held, and understanding how to hold our part of something. And you talk about this in terms of, you call it emotional self-responsibility. Could you just like riff on that for a bit?
Emotional labor? What context do you mean?
Well, I mean, like when you're doing this kind of work, right? Because what you're talking about when you say something about fragile masculinity or fragile white fragility, that kind of thing, you've got someone who's naming their experience, but in naming their experience, they're also expected to do the emotional labor on behalf of the person who's uncomfortable hearing that experience being named. It's a difficult balance because on the one hand, generally, right, being an asshole doesn't get anyone very far very fast. But on the other hand, how unfair is it to put back onto the marginalized communities who are already dealing with the trauma, mm-hmm, then right, the responsibility of managing, right, like, your emotions around your privilege, and that you're like, I don't like hearing that I'm privileged. Like, it is uncomfortable, you know, like even if it's not even call out, it's still an uncomfortable place to be working in. And it's something that I think about a lot in terms of like, how can I have a conversation with a man about sexism? How safe is that for me sometimes? And sometimes it's just like, I just choose not to do it because I'm like, you know what? I realize I'm going to have to do your emotional labor, and that's not my job. And if I have to do your emotional labor, then that means we're not really getting anywhere.
Yes. Every time you know, it's interesting. Every time you hear the word emotional labor, I get a headache. It's not just me in my soma, you know, in my body that is happening. And so kind of the wise crack version of me, the trickster version of me, would tell you, if you're doing emotional labor for free, one is that, and if I'm being really sarcastic, is it's like, well, maybe your emotional labor is not worth anything. Like, it's not worth anything in the sense it's not effective. So the way I see it is like, well, what if we provide an emotional service? Which is what I do. I do emotional labor for anybody. I'm selfish as hell. Like, I'm very, sometimes I do here and there because of some relationships, you know, you're like, okay, I'm going to lean into that a little bit today. But I consider in general my approach to life and to this work is emotional service. And so that means I come with the utmost care of how it's going to be received and expect there to be an exchange and set that up. So I think when people say I'm doing emotional labor, it's not the better way to, I feel like, look at this stuff is to hold up on the capitalist transactional language, because that's actually the system. That's like the matrix, right? And I call this kind of like jokingly between friends, like Newtonian social justice and quantum social justice. Like, you probably already got it, right? So Newtonian uses that rational cognitive language of binaries, like, you know, Newton's law of gravity is like an apple falls to the ground. It's like subject object. It's really simple. Quantum social justice to me means when you actually look at things the way they are, the reality of how things are, the particles behave completely differently from what we expect. So privilege and, you know, emotional labor, all those terms all of a sudden don't work. They fail to describe the actual thing that's happening. And so when you talk about emotional labor, I think we start also talking about like needing the other person to change and needing to fix, mm-hmm, and the codependency of that. And so maybe it's actually even a form of abuse in certain situations. It can lead into that. And, you know, then lateral violence starts happening. Like, so when you get into the more granular level of actual relationship, you start to realize all the parts actually behave a lot differently than how we perceive. But because we use our minds to understand social justice work, and not our soma and our feeling, we got really screwed up. So we understand things in a Newtonian way. And then the Newtonian layer is somewhat important, but it's actually founded on the quantum layer, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
The granular layer is actually what it's built on top of. So we're doing opposite. You know, words like privilege and stuff, again, that's what I'm saying. It doesn't mean anything unless you understand neurophysiologically in relationship what that actually means.
So how do you define emotional self-responsibility?
So in the context of, like, say, in doing emotional labor for, doing emotional labor for somebody is what it's called, right? The relationship dynamic looks more like, I need you to change for me to feel better. You know, you just apply the language of relationship counseling. It's really easy. It's actually, all the knowledge is out there. So that's why I mean it's also, there's like a really fragmented Western mind thing happening here too, because it's not that hard. Like, this part of my work is not like, I think, rocket science or like innovative at all, because the answers are already there. And, you know, relationship counseling will tell you everything about it. So emotional self-responsibility is, I'm going to be well even if you don't change. and trust your process of changing. And my responsibility is to take care of myself and make just choices in my life that are restorative to me. And I trust that that is, you know, it's like just like in a relationship, in a codependence, when you let go of the other person to be who they are and hold space and take care of yourself, that's when change happens. And that's the paradox. And that's what I mean, like, that's the quantum level, right? So on the Newtonian level, you're supposed to yell at the person and the person gets it and then they change. So that doesn't actually, that's not really it, because the all the emotions that were created in that interaction are held by the body. And so they're ready to explode at another time somewhere else. On the quantum level, we trust, hold loving presence, and then there's shifts. Sometimes it's messy, but the point is that there's an ability to, for things, the actual unconscious layers to shift and break that codependent pattern, right? Because a lot of racism and oppressions are really a codependence problem. It's a cultural codependence problem, if that makes sense. So that's a kind of how to understand and self-responsibility in relationship to your own happiness. It's the exact same. It's actually not any different. It's just kind of like this mental block to apply the principles of healthy relationship to something like allyship.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like that. Well, this quantum thing, I mean, it just makes me think about emptiness teachings and interconnectedness and anything I study in Buddhism, which is really that same sort of thing. Is like the absolute and the relative and the different perceptions that get brought to it, that kind of thing, which is an interesting one, because then for me this touches on a weird piece of tension that I have in the work that I do and the way I am in the world at the moment, because I've been doing a lot of work around this for a very long time, but I have compassion for difficult people because I see people who carry hatred, like that is suffering, they're suffering. And that's, it's painful to see that. And so I don't myself get a sense of anger or hatred. I actually get like, I'm not sure how familiar you are with teachings about bodhicitta.
It probably like culturally filters in, if that makes sense. My languaging might be different because I speak Chinese too. So
yeah, well, but it's also like, I know this is could be a bit of a Tibetan Buddhist approach in the way it's taught.
Okay, sure. I mean,
yeah,
I'm pretty Buddhist aware.
Aware. So bodhicitta, I mean, it means awakened heart, but the descriptions of it is the tender heart of sadness. And I read all this stuff describing it. And I remember the first times I started to connect with it, and that was what the connection was, is it's seeing someone, say like a very angry person protesting a gay pride parade, and not feeling a sense of disconnect from them and enemy, but instead feeling like this sense of my heart, like just opening up and breaking because this person is carrying so much hate, and how, what's that doing to them? Because I know what anger does to me if I'm unable to express it in healthy ways, or unable to channel the energy or use the energy in a way to, you know, inform myself in a skillful way. I'm like, yeah, that's painful. It's painful to live that way. But it's complicated to talk about, because there's this sense that some people are undeserving of compassion.
Yeah, that's certainly my experience. So your experience, you said, of that kind of breaking heart is my experience of white people. That's why I'm able to do the work that I do and the kind of way I hold the things. And I think it's the way a lot of people hold whiteness and white people who end up embodying that very strongly. But yeah, I think that's beautiful. And it's a grief, you know? I think that's also emotional self-responsibility to, now when the Buddhist idea of, I think, compassion is very, to me, a really important, interesting thing to apply, because that Buddhist sense of compassion doesn't try to fix the other person.
Yeah.
It's not a saviorship. It's a holding your own place and loving from afar, trusting the natural, and that unconditional positive regard, it's trusted in. And that is a very challenging space to hold, but And I think there's some like very nuanced textures in that, and I bring this up because people talk about empathy, but the Buddhist, that's that the breaking heart, or that, I don't know, the sad heart is not empathy, as I understand.
No, me neither. I think that empathy is really coming from a place of relating with from your own experience, and compassion is relating with regardless of whether or not you share the experience. And it's about what you're talking about not being transactional. I think people think of compassion as very transactional, and they think of empathy as very transactional. And it isn't. Like, it is a sense of inclusiveness, of sacredness
right.
for all people involved.
Or at least, you know, like, if we should create useful definitions. So, you know, if we make empathy and compassion the same thing, it's not very useful to describe an experience, I think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think of empathy, and I have a lot to say about that, too. And empathy, to me, is just a natural physical response.
Yeah.
Of absorbing each other's emotions. Compassion is self-regulation and empathy built on top of that. So the ability to feel other people's emotions and the subtle energetic transfers, but compassion is built on top of your ability to hold space for that through self-regulation of your own nervous system. And I think one of the challenges that we face actually, and the reason why there is call-out culture, is because we're over-reliant on empathy. We become overly invested in other people's need, like needing other people to change, when we use empathy, and that makes us quite dysregulated. And so there's a lot of resentment that comes from that, bubbles up into things like call out culture. And yeah, so again, yeah, that's why, like, when I say the foundation of the group that we work with, the first webinar, for example, is like this whole thing. Whatever you do, always, you can always come back to self-awareness and self-regulation, no matter what. That's step one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you think you screwed up, you can always come back to that. And, you know, and supporting that is that kind of paradigm you're talking about, is that tender heart. But that tender heart is sitting on top of a very strong foundation that holds and contains the tears. I really appreciate that you mentioned that, because I think that's a really important distinction, and how, you know, to talk about how much relating too much from an empathetic place actually burns our nervous system out, because we're feeling other people's emotions too much. It's not actually healthy.
That's why I don't like the term compassion fatigue.
It's empathy. Yeah, it's empathy fatigue. It's not compassion fatigue. Okay. And I even go to say empathy is like the origin of unnecessary evil, right? Because you relate to somebody's feelings so much and absorb too much of somebody's emotional energy, you start to make the other person responsible for your somatic nervous system state, which is how it's committed to, because then you see, you become disconnected from yourself, but your unconscious starts to go, if I harm this other person and make them stop, then I will feel better. You know, and that is actually a transaction of violence. You know, again, the emotional labor piece, that's why I think that argument starts to go into abuse very easily, because that is what's happening and operating underneath that conversation, right? Again, it's like that on the Newtonian level, right? There's a person with privilege that's bad, and they have to change their behavior. But on the quantum level, depending on how the, you know, it's not that either person's really bad. They're caught in a codependent dynamic, both of them. And it's up to each person to separate, or at least disentangle and start regulating. And it's not a whose fault it is all of a sudden. It's not as easy as that.
Yeah, seeing that interrelationship. What would you like to offer as a gift or a guidance to listeners who are engaged in this kind of work?
I have some big ideas that are coming out right now. I might as well talk about them. That might be the gift, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I ask the people who are listening to, like, actually listen with their bodies too, seeing how their body's registering this idea, but is really to rebuild social justice culture from the ground up, from the understanding of the nervous system as like a foundation for wellness of our being, and understanding that our culture, our collective experience, our culture is a type of soma as well. So culture is soma. Culture is a body created out of the interwebbing of different nervous systems and relationship. And so I call this the cultural autonomic nervous system. So our culture has all the branches of the nervous system as well that our bodies have. And this means that the way we repair our culture to facilitate the natural healing process of our culture is the same as the way we heal our individual bodies. So what does that mean? That means embodiment culture, and that means creating safety and connecting back to the earth in a felt sense, in a somatic sense, not in like the cognitive sense, but like the felt sense, to ground, to create safety and a space for emotional resiliency and risk-taking, and really challenge and be in the discomfort of recognizing that a lot of the things that we've built, our ideas of social change, quote-unquote, don't reflect our wellness. It's the job of the brain to listen to the body, not the other way around. And so we listen to the institutions, and even in social justice cultures, this institutionalized thought about, you know, if a person has less privilege than you, you have to do X, or the person has more privilege, they deserve to do, you deserve to have X be done, or all kinds of laws and like ideas that are really cognitive based on like this really transactional language, right? Mm-hmm. That in our individual bodies first shows up as whiteness, shows up as masculinity, right? Shows up as capitalism, which is also like the domination of the mind over the body, right? In a class structure. So it shows up that way. And even in our bodies, we know when our minds are wanting to control the body, when in reality, our nervous system is built in a way that actually our soma, with the enteric nervous system at its center, right, and then messages going out the, I don't know if everybody it follows that, but goes up the vagus nerve to the brain, but whatever. The point is, the body is sending wisdom to the brain, but we treat it like the brain is controlling the body, and that is actually not the truth. And so the ways in which we can have social restoration is to really lean into that and follow that, is let our body speak. And so instead of following this top-down idea like these institutions give us, is to create knowledge and wisdom from our soma, from our bodies up, and listen to our bodies and listen and say, if this doesn't feel good, or maybe, you know, you're being called out and this feels like abusive. That is the soma speaking. There's wisdom there. And again, there's all kinds of more complex questions, or how do you deliver that information? Sure, but the first thing is to recognize that your body is speaking, because the silencing of the body is what oppression is in all of its forms, really. Yeah, and that's like the kind of also matrix that we live in. We think it's ableism, we think it's, you know, misogyny and all these things, but really what's underlying all those things is a disrespect for the nervous system and soma. So listening to the body and letting that inform how we practice pretty much everything is actually a natural way to just restore. In some ways, it's not that complicated. There's bumps, a lot of bumps, like people get really hurt along those bumps, but it's actually in terms of how you do it, it's not that complicated. You listen deeper and deeper and deeper into your body, and let that inform how you live in all of the ways. Let the institutions hear our bodies talking to the brain, not the other way around. So, yeah, I think that's, I don't know if that's a gift, but I think that's like an idea that we can really work with, and also give ourselves really the space to say, like, hey, me going and meditating in a park today, that is social restoration. Because social restoration happens at the soma level. It doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. Everything that, again, you know, everything that happens on the higher, on so-called higher levels, like the institutional systemic levels, are an expression of what's happening at the somatic level. So, like, really taking care of soma and inquiring and healing and really leaning in, that's the process. Again, if you're like a white person listening to this, it's like figuring out 10 ways to help people of color and reading lists is not going to, it doesn't mean anything unless you know yourself. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't. It's It easily steeps into codependence and actually hurts people of color in relationship, even if they're asking you to read those lists. And that's the, again, that's the Newtonian versus quantum thing, you know, like when somebody, maybe you're a man and a woman is saying like, I need you to do these X things and know these X things. It's like, if you, like, think about a relationship. It's never about the dishes.
That's really good.
Dishes. Okay. Yeah. Listen to somebody's emotional needs. Not the, like, you know, unless you're doing that, you're not listening. So those lists and articles you like take in and you think, oh yeah, this must be the truth. That's not you listening. Listening means being fully present with the feelings and emotions of the other person without taking them on. And you still need to discern whether that is right or wrong for you. So I don't know, I got a bit passionate about that, but like I think that's like a huge mental block for people. It's like going, oh, you know, like if a person is less privileged than you, do you have to like listen to them? It's like, no, you don't. Not in that sense. Don't, you know, don't collapse. It's not okay for you to. That's neglect. If you collapse your identity because somebody is telling you X, that's actually a form of neglect almost. You're not being present. What being present is being resilient enough to be there and amidst the emotions, hold the space and really tune in. It's like, what is the emotional need that wants to be addressed? And listen in, and can I meet those needs within my needs? And go from there. So that was very long-winded, but there's a lot of gifts, but then we're like Santa Claus, but like, I don't know.
That's good. That's all good stuff. Thank you so much. Tada Hozumi runs an online program, the Authentic Allyship Coaching Group, consults around allyship with individuals and organizations, and is currently writing a book on building healthier relationships in social restoration communities. Their work is founded on the principles of mutual nourishment, enthusiastic consent, trust, and intimacy. You can connect with Tada and find out more about their work at selfishactivist.com. To find out more about my work in the world, to get in touch with me, or to become a patron, visit caitlinschatch.com. The link is in the show description. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott. Thank you to Tejai Moore of Moore Music for the original theme song.